This conversation with Elvin Hampton took place at his home in Genesee on May 3, 1976. The interviewer is Sam Schrager.
Started farming here.
Oh, well, he came out. At a fairly young age, I suppose that he was probably about maybe 26, something like that. Came to Dayton over there. It seemed like a lot of the early pioneers came to Dayton about that time, and he worked there a little while, and he told me about fishing up in those creeks up in there. And then for some reason or other, he moved on further out here, and there were several other fellows with him from Carolina, and I know we used to go to visit one, I forget his name now, up around east of Moscow. And of course in those days they wanted to homestead a little bit up in the timber country, and they tried that. Several of his friends did, and probably established a homestead, but he said for some reason or other he didn't like that. It seemed kind of slow to him, sitting out there building a cabin and cutting timber, and he just wasn't quite he wasn't quite adapted to the timber life as some of these other men. And so then he migrated, I think, right down here in this area, and worked on a farm for, well, right just out here, a couple of miles by the highway as you come by. I remember there probably used to be a greaser out there, and he talked about plowing with a foot burner out there for a few years, and then he happened to travel out east of Genesee then, and ran on to a place out there that was for sale by an insurance company. It seemed like in those earlier days insurance companies had possession of those properties, and he said he bought that piece of ground back there without even going back off of the road to look at it. He said the land looks so good from the road, and he just purchased that place there then, and started building some, I guess there were some old buildings on it there, but he built up on it and improved on it, and then he just kept gradually in those days adding a little more to his holdings there, and he was next to the Indian land, the reservation, Nez Perce Reservation down there, and the Indians could sell their land then, and some of the Indians that owned the property was, well, it wasn't too productive then, and then they ran a few cattle on it, and they weren't too successful, so they were willing to sell to somebody who would cultivate it. And then it wasn't anything like it is today, because they had operated with horses and in the original, and then and later with mules that he used there because of the hiring people, as I told you before about.
Let me ask you this: did he ever tell you why he decided to leave Carolina and why he wanted to come west?
No, I just can't recall unless it was that. I think he lived. His family wasn't too large. Wasn't on that basis. But I suppose he just was ambitious, and it seemed like back there They worked on a smaller scale. Whether he heard about this country or I don't know, but they raised tobacco back there, and it was a kind of a it was a hard task and a menial job and a manual labor, and outside of that, I just don't really know.
You think he probably had the idea of owning his own spread and not.
Well, I think so. When he, I think that he was that type of a man. I don't know what happened. He played a banjo. He had a banjo.
Over there at the end of the fire.
What?
On my feet over there at the end of the fire.
Oh, yeah. And I kept that, and he used to play, you know, at rainy days. I never learned how to play that, but there's his old banjo. And you can see, and it was a five-string banjo. And of course, I have gone up, I've been musical. I went to the singing route. And you can see where he just picked this. He never did use a pick. I got this pick here to do it, but there's a five-string banjo, and he'd pick that. And I remember, well, I guess before I knew about it, he probably played out the dances and things like that. And whether he'd learned to play that back home, I don't know.
Wouldn't surprise me, because it was an instrument they played in the South, you know, more than out here.
And he could sit and play these old tunes, you know, old Joe Clark. And I remember sitting around the coal stove at home out there at the ranch, and when it was rainy days, like, he'd get out this banjo and play it, and he loved that, and he always loved music. Hmm. And I took up the singing, and I did a lot of singing, and I still do, and did that in my life. And we had a lot, but I refurbished that and fixed it up, and that's the old banjo.
That's a nice looking instrument.
That's an old instrument.
Well, when do you think he landed here?
Well, I think in about 1886 or 89, something like that.
So there was no homestead land to be had around Tennessee by then. No,
it was up in the timberland, and you had to go down here and purchase it. It was hard to then, when you acquired your properties then, it was difficult to work it, because you had to travel, and you didn't have, you know, we didn't have the mobility that we have today. It's hard for to visualize that. We hauled our grain with wagons to town, and in my time, it amazes me that I can think back that we did that. We traveled by sled, and those early days that I never got to town like now, unless we got to town, you know, on the 4th of July or some space of time. Hardly ever went out for lunch any place. That would be something.
Well, why would that be?
We were so busy then, in those days. And so, unless you went for a purpose then. If you took your surrey and your team, you went to town to provide groceries. Or else you took your, in the fall, you took your wheat to grind it at a flour mill. Or, they had one down here. And so in those days, you went for a purpose. You didn't say, well, then we'll just go in and get the mail, or we'll go in and get a quart of milk. You didn't have to get milk then, because you had milk cows. I milked a cow even after I was married in my family. And we butchered our hogs, our pork. We had our bacon and cured all of that, and made our lard and made the soap. And there was a lady down here, Mrs. Kern, used to come out, and I can see her in the yard yet. We'd put a fork and hold her up and put this big round pot in there and boil that lard and stir it, and out there in the wind, and stir it, you know, and it hardened.
She would come over to make soap?
Yeah, she was a woman who lived in town here, a German lady, and she knew how to do that. And so we'd always get her to come out, and she would take charge of that. Huh. And she was special, you might say. And then And we cut this meat up, you know, and had no place, no refrigeration, and no place in town. You had to cure it and can your meat. And then in the summertime, when we needed meat, we'd kill a lamb. We had sheep. We'd kill a lamb whenever we need some fresh enough to eat it. And we'd maybe kill a beef. It'd cure out in the cool of the night, you know. Of course, the hogs we butchered in the wintertime when it was cold. Oh, we used to butcher a dozen or more hogs.
Really?
Yeah, of course, we had men in the summertime, quite a few men. And it took a lot of food, a lot of baking, baked all the bread, you know. So when I talk about that, I think, well, fellas, doesn't really, the guy is talking through his hat, you know. You're in this generation, but when you think, and I often recall how I think back how this change has come. And I told you about something here last time I was here. And there's a picture of those mules and their combine. And that's in 31. Well, 31 was, that was 2 years before I graduated out of college. And I was driving teen marriage. And then you see how we progressed when we had this. And then this thing back here, you see, we started with a tractor.
Mm-hmm.
We had a tractor that was a smaller one. And we just experimented with that. And then eventually, here a little later, the last year after this one, I think in 33, well, we used 6 mules back here, and we put this tractor up in front, and we cut off all these mules up here. We're trying to cut off, you know, we're trying to get changed over to the mechanized system.
Would you explain to me again why it was that your father preferred the mules to the horses? He was in the minority opinion around this country.
Oh yes, I don't suppose there were too many. I can't think of too many more, except there used to be a fella up in Boyd's up around Moscow, were big operators, and generally had to be bigger operators. He did that because I think I have some pictures of horses down there that the casualty rate in horses was pretty high, because they're more of a a personalized animal. You have to look after them. You have to not get them overheated or watch their food. For instance, they'll founder. Whereas this mule won't do that. He will take care of himself. If he's too hot when he comes in and you've been working him hard in the field, he won't drink water. And when you take him up to the barn, he won't, he'll never hardly find a mule that'll founder. He won't just jump in and eat all that grain that he's got there. He'll ration himself.
Well, did this have to do with his thinking that with a lot of hired men it would be easier to look after
him? Yeah, that's where, you know, he just couldn't be in out there every day and caution the man. He'd hire a man and say, there's your 6 or 7 mules. You go up there and harness them. And there's the grain. We'd have a bulk grain in a bin and go feed those, you know. Instead of, you know, how a man would come in, if he's a careless man, he would come in and take a bucket and maybe dump a couple of gallons instead of 1 gallon and 1 box and maybe not that so much in the other. Well, if he did that to the mule, he wouldn't be sick the next morning. And I imagine he found out when that happened the next morning when the men went up there to work, he'd probably say, well, here, I got a sick horse. And then, well, that probably held up his unit all day. And it was quite a problem. And then not only horses were, they were temperamental.
Horses?
I remember him telling about nice, pretty big horses, and they would come in here and trade during a week, maybe, and they're balky. You'd get a nice, big horse, you know, what they call a cold-shouldered horse, and he just wouldn't hit that collar. And the fella, he'd come in and trade that horse off, and he'd think he was a nice one. Well, the next morning, or the next Monday morning, when he hooked him up to leave town or something, or had a load, well, that horse wouldn't pull, and there he would be.
What's cold shoulder?
Well, he just wouldn't hit that collar, you know. They'd put a big old collar on him, you know, and what they call them, cold shouldered. He just wouldn't hit. He'd just back up. He'd just hit that little bit and just back right up in the traces. I've seen him do that. Pretty great big horses. They're just what they call their balky.
So you trade for a horse then? You were taking chances? Huh?
So lots of time my dad would tell about how he'd come in. He'd get stuck, you know, and the next weekend he'd have to wait till the next week maybe. He'd have to substitute some way. Well, he'd bring this nice pretty horse back, you know, and brothers would come by and they'd probably be a same proposition as he was, but nobody knew what the matter, so they'd trade horses. That's what they called horse traders, you know. That's what the horse traders got their name. And they would look around and trade, and he'd go back and smile and say, well, that fella hooks that horse up, he's going to be a truancy.
Well,
so it was quite
you think this had something to do with why he preferred mules?
Yeah.
They were
yeah,
less
that's
of a risk.
Why they were more reliable and less of a risk. And you know, if he had a man to work a team and he couldn't go buy a horse or replace him, we generally had two or three mules who were extras, you know, or they'd get hurt or something else. And very seldom would you. And another thing, that they're not a nervous type of animal. If they ever get in a wire fence, they'll stand there till you come and get them. And a horse will just tear himself apart. Seen a horse get in there and just get excited and just cut his legs off on a barbed wire fence. So you can see the advantages of that kind of animal.
I take it that he started himself with horses and decided to turn to mules.
Yeah, I remember when they had horses. And he had these horses. I could show you a picture down there of all those horses lined out where he's using them. But he switched pretty early in my life.
Do you?
Because I was a young boy then.
Do you know where he went for his meal supply?
Oh, I remember he would go. You see, you have to breed those, you know. They won't reproduce. Mules won't reproduce, and you have to breed a jack with a horse. And there was fellas that would raise those. Like I said, these Boyds up here who did that, and they had kept a bunch of brood mares. And they would, I remember one time we went, and I don't know whether you went to Montana or someplace, and we bought a bunch of yearling or two-year-old pretty mules, and my dad left me there with another hired man to learn to tie these up, you know. And they were pretty. They had some bay ones. They were pretty. They were different colors, you know. Generally they're brown, but you see there's some white ones there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pretty fellas, and we had a lot of fun tying those things up.
Well, listen, did he get ribbed about having mules instead of horses by guys around here? It's so unusual.
No.
Me.
No, I don't think anybody ever did that because they knew the advantage of it. But then, of course, you take a fella, if he was an individual farmer and he took pride in his horses and watched them and took care of them, he could get by a lot better, you know, because he knew just how much to feed him, any particular horse. But where you had five or six fellas working, why, you know, and maybe one man would leave you or somebody else, and you had breaking in. Of course, it didn't change too much in those days. If a man was a mule skinner, what they call a mule skinner, why, he stayed for maybe year after year.
Well, I'd like to talk about that some. Maybe first, but I'd like to talk about the operation itself. But first, maybe you tell me how he went from being a small farmer to a pretty good-sized operator.
You know, wait, I'll turn it off. And there's my dad standing on the stack pile. You see, that's when I used to have those thrashing machines. That's where it comes. Now here's one out the place where they had these mules. See, they'd all come in here to drink, and here's the fellas. It's lined up there. They're working in this place. And here's, that would be a picture of the crew that summer. Shows you there. Yeah, there's my dad. There I am, and my brother. And here's a fellow that worked for us for many, many years. And here's what I say when they had these horses. they would have colts and stuff. Now, that's in 1904. You see, there'd be seven, I think there's six or seven to a team, six, I guess. Well, here's my homestead, the original. I lived, and I lived in that house, I was born in that house. Here's a picture of a combine that I took when we had that. Later on was the tractor.
What was the means by which he built up his place?
Oh, he was
small
just
size.
He was quite a trader, and then he raised livestock. He would have some sheep. We had quite a few sheep, hogs, and everything, you know, self-sufficient, you know. And the grain was, you know, wasn't too productive a thing. The yield wasn't too high then. And he was a good manager. He just whatever that the land produced, and he protected that and was able to come out on it, you know. We didn't lay away a lot of money. And of course, property wasn't as high then. You didn't have a big cash flow. And just about the only, you just didn't buy gasoline or stuff like that. You just put it into what little labor you had there. And lots of times he would provide, you know. I've known some fellas that would just come out there and work for their board, chop wood and work for the wintertime and maybe. And keep the place together while we were in school.
Well, did he save up enough money to put it down on more land and buy more? Did he expand that way?
Oh, yeah. He would save a little, and he would always borrow at the bank down here. There was a fellow named Bressler who was a good banker, and he would stay with him, and he would loan him the money, lots of time, put near all of it. And maybe he'd have a crop of wheat or barley. But like I say, the cash flow wasn't very great. And your expense was great. You had a lot of labor. And you had to handle it with sacks and sew them and haul them. It was slow, but what you did was comparable, more so than it is today, I guess.
Well, did he mind being in debt and being extended on?
No, I guess he saw the opportunity was great, and people weren't too anxious. It was hard to have a crew and horses and stuff like that if you're willing to go on. And the opportunity was there, you know. And I know that in those days you had more land than you wanted.
Really?
Practically, yeah. You just had more land you wanted. You scattered around. Nobody seemed to want it.
Well, what's the Driscoll part of the partnership? How did he go into partnership?
Well, he was a man here that had been a school teacher and was a slight type of a man, not a farmer type, but a financier. And he ran a hardware store down here. And he saved his money and looked around, and he went in partnership with my dad, helped to finance him. And so dad did the operation, he paid him a salary, and he made the living, see, and so he, even in that early days, why he did it from a financial standpoint, and so my dad knew the farming end of it, so they formed a partnership, just like you. Lots of times you form a partnership.
Did this mean they had separate land holdings at the same time?
Yeah.
Your father had his own land that
when
he was farming.
When they acquired land, it's like where that team is, that was on his place there, you see. Why, he would buy a piece of land. He bought a piece of land where that was what they call a troutman place. And then they added, and then from then on they added each one. See, he had his place over where this homestead was, see, and he lived there. It's about a mile from there. And he would, when property would come up, why, they would buy take maybe a half, an 80 that laid next to them, and next to their property, which would be more convenient while they'd buy it that way. And when Indian land came up, why, my dad more or less bought that down in Nesper's area. I don't know of Driscoll ever buying any of that. Why he didn't, I don't know.
So once he got going, how much land was he actually farming?
Oh, when he was farming there, they had around just about 2,000 acres. They each had about 1,000 acres.
About when would this have been?
Oh, that would have been in the 30s. Well, up to the 30s, 35. And when Driscoll died, he died first. Boy, his daughter went in partnership. They had a partnership, and I went in partnership with her. And we farmed for quite a few years.
Do you have much of an idea of how many years it took your father to be farming that much? I mean, he probably started with, what, 160 acres?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I suppose that they bought that in 1890. I suppose he started in about 1895. And it took him about, it took him 30, 40 years.
To build up to that,
yeah.
2000. But they were doing some kind of partnership by 1900 already,
yeah.
Because they had the threshing crew as a joint.
Yeah.
As a joint crew.
Yeah.
So your father, from what you were mentioning before, he looked at himself as a manager. I mean, that's what he wanted to
do. Yeah, there's
a
picture of him up there. Very stern. Man, I never can think of him driving a team. He was always a man who was out managing.
I think you should tell him about the Gulf Creek idea. Told you how to drive.
Oh, one time we were, when I was young, and we had these push binders, which is that you drive with six mules, and there's a beam, you know, and it's more or less came closer to what these combines are now, you know, because the binder would go ahead of, you know, your team, and it cut your reel, would cut that, although the bull wheel would knock down your wheat. And, so I was a young fella then, and I remember going, starting up the road with his team, and if you had a green team, it was a little hard to hold him in a little bit, and you had a rudder, just like a rudder, it reminds me of these outboard motors you could just swing around, but this rudder had a C on it with a wooden peg in between it, and you'd guide it like this, you know, just like this, swing like this, you know, I think you understand what I mean. I don't have a picture of one of those. And so my dad was along the road one day, and I was coming along, and I was diving in and out like this, trying to keep my team in, you know, and one thing and another. And he's telling me what to do, and a very patient fella, though. And finally I jumped off, and I said, well, you take it. And he said, no, son. He says, I don't know how to do it, but he says, I know how it should be done. So I got back on that, and I stayed with it. I thought that was good enough for me. So he had done some earlier work when he was a young fella. He had worked hard. But he was a good manager, good figure. He always never threw anything away, never said anything. Treated his employees as good. And was always a fair man.
What kind of dimensions now, as far as the size of the crew and the amount of stock, did he need to farm
2,000 acres.
Well, he just probably needed it, you know. There's lots of times he wouldn't get it plowed or done, you know. And the pressure is great. I remember even in a partnership to produce. I remember now this Driscoll was a fella who could come out and take a look at things. They could drive around, you know, and inspect and see, well, have you got it seeded right, or is it going? He wouldn't know how to seed it, but whether it, he would know the end result.
And I by the one, size of the wheat growing in the field.
I know at one time he would come out, and that would make you kind of nervous after you'd been working. And I remember my dad said that he came out and looked at the crop, and he says, it isn't going to make very much. I don't know what he said, 20 bushels or something, you know. And my dad said, he said, I'll buy your share out of that. And he said, that shut him up. He never said any more. So that's the way you had to get it on. So it's not an easy life.
A lot of responsibility. He did have to.
For his own good, but for the good of his partner, and of course he was working. He would get wages for his part of managing.
Do you know what kind of wages he got?
Oh, it wasn't very much. Maybe he'd get $2,000 at the most
for the season's work.
Yeah, that would have been a pretty good salary. Those days, I remember we were working just like those drivers that worked for $2, dollar and a half, or $2 a day, in furnishing board and room. And we'd, in the harvest time, get a little more, but I worked lots of days for $2.50. Thought that was pretty good. Work hard, too, lots of days, lots of hours.
What kind of day was it? When you were working, I mean, was it like a 10-12 hour day?
Oh yeah, we would get up at 5 o'clock and go up to the barn and feed those horses, those mules, and harness them. And lots of times we had lanterns sitting up there. Of course it wouldn't be in the morning, but at night, they were hanging on the peg and we had to light that lantern to feed them at night. But we would go up there and then when we got them harnessed and fed, that early in the morning, we'd go down and eat breakfast. We had this lady cook there, you'd see her there, and she cooked for as many, many years. She just operated that house. And we would go down there and eat, and then we'd go back and take our teams out and go out in the field, and then come in for 12 at noon and feed them and water them again, put them up in the barn, and then maybe lay down a little while at noon. It wasn't like now, we'd have to go back to work. We'd go down and maybe have a little nap, 10, 15, 20 minutes, to give the team time enough to eat. And then we'd get back in about 6 o'clock at night. We never worked really late at dark hours, but of course when the fall would come, it'd get darker quicker. But we kept regular hours. When you had the crew, you had to keep regular hours. Be in at the meal time so the cooks would know when the men would be in, not straggling in. Very disciplined program. And you know what to expect of everybody. That's the way you operate.
How hard would you consider the work was? Would you be working about really up close to your limit, or was it really
easy? It wasn't. You see, when you're plowing or standing, it would be a tiresome job, or sometimes when you're haying, it would be a more difficult job, but nothing slavery about it. Gosh, no, a fella could stand and enjoy it. Everybody enjoyed it and made the job. But it took a lot of time. Just couldn't hurry the thing. You had so much time. That's why you had to be out there to go around and get around us in those fields and get that much work done.
Did it call for a lot of teamwork on the part of the crew, or was it more?
Oh yeah, it's like you saw there with those horses. There would be a man, the fella would be the leader, and it was up his responsibility to get out there and get the teams going, see? It's like the fella, who is it, the head one, you know, maybe the guys sit around, lay around a little, but he's got to jump right out the bunkhouse. We'd sleep in the bunkhouse, and what we called a bunkhouse for the men, and he would have to get out, and he would have to be the first one out there. He'd have to depend on him, and sometimes you'd pay him a little more for being the leader, not sitting down out there or something. So you had incentives.
What did you usually do in the harvest? Did you have one job you kind of stuck to, or did...
Well, when I was younger, I worked with this older fella, like I tell you there. Why, we put up hay. I was a little bit too young, I guess, to be out shocking. Then's when we had shocking. And then I finally graduated when I was smaller. I carried water with a team, two mules and a buggy to the shockers. We'd have maybe 15 shockers before we had a combine. But of course, when we got up to a combine stage, of course, that was my word, just practically late, you might say, up in the 28th, 29th. But before that, from the 1918 on up in there, why, I did the menial job, or I drove a derrick on a hay stacker, you know. And actually, that was hard as a man's job, but that was a kid's job. A man wouldn't hardly do that, you know. A guy's tedious, backing the team mule up, just back him up. You just wear the grass out, you know, where you do that. And I used to hate that worse than anything else because of a tedious job, but I stayed with it.
Because you were a kid? Yeah. You were expected to do that?
Yeah. It was a light enough job, but a tedious one. I couldn't handle a fork or something like that, but I could do that. Now it'd be automated.
How old were you when you first started to work in farming?
Oh, I started then. Of course, before that, I herded sheep, herded cattle, did anything like that when you're old enough to ride a horse. And and then, of course, automation started maybe in the 20s, and of course I learned to drive an old Ford truck about those times, you know, just barely could look over the dashboard. And but there's always work, or I could use rake with the team. I remember I used to rake hay, and you could work in the hay. We did a lot of haying then. We put in about 30 days of haying because we had to provide all the feed, fill the barns, to feed those animals all summer and winter. And it just took a lot of that. And it did chores, milk cows, feed pigs. We always had pigs, petting them hogs, selling them, you know.
What was the idea when you were a kid that your father had about paying you for the work that you did? When did you start getting paid for the farm?
Well, he always paid us some. We just didn't work or nothing. He always had an incentive. I'd work, when I would work in the summertime and have my own money here. And when I went to school, I had my own account. And he didn't expect us to provide for the system. Of course, we were in a different than a family thing. We're in a partnership. We provide and work for this other fellow. So naturally, I'd do work for my family. But then, why should I work for the other fellow? You see,
for the family, yeah. Then for your family, that was more chore work.
Yeah, so that's why when you had it in a partnership, why. Everybody had to participate some way, and had to be an expense out of it. So old gardens or stuff like that on a home garden, you know, would mean nothing, you know. But when I was old enough to go out there and take a job and do something along with the with the farming operation, why it was paid for.
How many men did he usually have working? I'm sure it varied from season to season.
Of course it would vary. Take in the spring, there would be 5 or 6 men. And mostly in the fall. And of course during harvest, before we got into harvesting, when we were thrashing, I remember. Well, then that would take 15 or 20 men for 25 or 30 days. But then when we got into that combining, then we would have about 10 men.
But for the steam thrashing, they had their own outfit that they
used. Of course, that was contracted.
Oh, that was contracted.
Yeah, he didn't own that attachment. There's a fellow that would go to the thrashing, and they would just do that. They would move, because you couldn't have that big outfit and just go and do 10, 20 days, move to another place 10, 20 days, and they did that on a contract basis. And they would provide everything, and that was their management problem. Once you got you had to bind the wheat and shock it, put in the shock, then the thrasher would come down and pick it up and everything else and put it in that pile, even that sack pile. And then when it was sacked, we'd haul it to town.
And they brought in all their own men to do that work too.
They had their own crew.
So the crew that was on your place wasn't that big then.
No, after that, you see, only for your shocking and stuff, but you wouldn't have it. And they would have, a thrashing crew like that would probably be 20 men.
Well, for the crews that were working for your father, how long would those men be employed? Would they be there for the... from the spring till the fall, or how would that work?
Oh yeah, they'd be there at the spring and till clear on the fall. They would keep those fellas there.
This would be maybe 8-10 men around.
Well, not quite that many. I'd say at least 6, maybe. He'd have 6 or 7 teams, like that. I don't think we had any more than that. But it went down, and of course, in the winter time, there wasn't too much to do. I think those fellas, some of them would go home, I guess, or live with their families. I know they wouldn't have too many in the winter time. 2 or 3 men, maybe.
Would these be local men? They would be local.
Yeah. All those longer-term men would be local. The other men, when you had this shocking stuff, they would be transients. They would be fellows that come in here on a train, just like apple pickers that come down in the apple countries, and they'd work. And that's when you'd have problems. You may take a man, that's when he'd be busy. He may come in and pick up a man and take him out, and maybe just take another man back to town. It wouldn't work, or it wouldn't be good, or something. He'd be alcoholic or stuff like that. You may run into all those things.
Would it usually be different men that your father would pick up every year, or would he get the same guys coming
no,
from year to
they
year?
No, would generally be different men.
This
they
is on these transients.
Yeah, they would probably never get back in here unless he was a specialized man. If he was a sack sower, or he was a specialized somebody. If he was just an ordinary laborer, you could never depend on a repeat.
So I take it that made some of the biggest headaches that he would have during
personnel
the
was a great problem then. Yeah, you just never knew whether they would produce for you or not. And some fellas would maybe just come out and get a good meal and quit.
That sounds like the old camp inspectors in the logging camps. They used to call those guys who would go from camp to camp for a meal and a place to sleep.
Yeah.
And he would find these guys right in town. That's where he'd pick them up.
Yeah, they used what they call a jungle down here where this Cow Creek runs down there, and there's a crosser bridge down there. I crossed every time I go out to my place. And the train would come in there, the depot's there, and the train would come in. These fellas would come in there, and they'd camp in there. Lay a blanket down, have a pot. Some guys would have something to eat, and it'd be somebody I can remember as a kid. There'd be somebody in there, but there all the time. Maybe he's a camp tender. And we'd pick those people up right there. You'd have to be a judge of a man to go in there. And you'd pick some good men. Some wouldn't be worth anything.
I mean, he would just talk to one individually,
yeah.
One at a time?
Yeah,
he'd
have to interview himself there. Yeah. That's about the only way you could employ people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I take it there was a big difference between these fellas and the guys that were
regular fellas. They were local fellas. They were trained and family men, I might say. Here, I can remember. And some of those fellas, and some of those people would come from back to Carolina. Now, some of those fellas, boys that came out here, and he gave them jobs, and they worked here, and then they eventually started farming for themselves. I know several.
Do you think they knew when they came out that he was out here, or they had connections?
Oh, yeah, I think so, knew he was here, because, in fact, quite a few of these fellas were from back there.
In Carolina?
Yeah, there's that fella, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, those six guys from back to Carolina. These are the old fellas. This old fella was a fella that came back quite a few years. He was a good mule driver. He drove the combine before I ever drove. And this fella was a sack sower.
Well, that's real interesting. So in that way, he was helping these fellas to get a start.
They were coming out here and wanted to get a start.
Was that?
I can't think of those fellas that went farmed. There's some other fellas before that, earlier.
Well, do you think that for these guys that were doing that work, from what I understand about it, working as a hired man was certainly, less desirable for a man than being able to farm his own place would be if he could do it. And I'm wondering, do you think that's what most of these people had in mind? Or do you think...
Oh, no. They came out here and most of those fellas went back.
To Carolina?
Yeah, most of those said maybe one or two. Yeah, they wanted to see what the West was like. They'd come out here. And my dad was patient, he would train them, and they could work.
Would these fellows be there a year after
year? No, just the summer. Yeah. Most of those fellows just stayed there one summer.
Well, would you say in general that his hired hands were a different group each year then? Or
yeah, pretty much so. Yeah, they, like I say, those there, probably there's five or six of those that didn't come back. Well, a couple of them stayed over the winter. Of course, in the winter time, we didn't have anything to do. We just feed them. It cost them much to feed them. We didn't pay anything, just keep them maybe a month or two.
So, your idea, what it was for him. I mean, you have to, if you're the foreman, and in charge of the men, have good relations with him. Did he find it easy to have them all, everybody working together and them doing what he wanted them to do?
Well, yes, he really didn't. Outside of a leader, he never had a foreman as per se. He was a foreman, mm-hmm. But he would have, if for instance, if you had one leader, like I said there, towards get the team out. The outside of that, why, he'd give every man his job, and he'd always be available and out there, and and operating, you know. He did the foreman work. he didn't delegate this outside of a, you know, temporary leadership.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking is how well do you think that those guys would get along? I mean, would they do just what he would want them to do?
Oh yeah, there was no problem. Gosh, you just couldn't find jobs. You know, two other funny ones didn't make it too tough. Made it just as pleasant as possible. Had a job to do, and there wasn't any arm twisting. You know, it was just, you know, and when you get in with a group, and of course, you know, you can see there, he had younger fellas that are capable and willing to do, or willing to learn, you know. It wasn't those days that you couldn't fall back on food stamps or welfare or nothing else. That was it. You didn't make that, you didn't get a fair back home. But that wasn't held over you. But you fellas had pride in their work then. That's it. I say, you know, the ones that you knew and you had longer time, like I say, at some of these other transient people, that was a different problem. And it wasn't quite so widespread because you were busy during those times. Of course, it seemed like we got over those periods in a few years. We started in the war times, 1918 on up to 20, for 10 or 12 years in there. It was pretty tough.
They said that, I know in the logging camps during World War I, there was a lot of trouble with the strikes, and the IWW was in the camps, and there was some concern for a while at that time that they were going to try to do some things in the fields too, in the farming. Did you ever hear about that?
Yes, we had. They were IWWs. They talked about those there, down in here, and they were concerned about that at the time, you know, about fires. But it never got. It never got to the point where it was dangerous. But I remember them talking about that. I'm concerned about fellas. Naturally, if you go down here to the jungle and pick up a guy, if he's dissatisfied or something, he could drop a match out there and burn you up. And so he, if a fellow went out and he would eat, maybe you'd give him a meal and you'd probably be mad about it and you want to go back to town. Well, you better take him instead of let him sit around the bunkhouse. Or make him walk, you see.
Well, did he have to do a lot of logistics was all this land together? Was it spread out enough?
No, it's pretty well spread out. Lots of times we'd have to move our feeding racks 3 or 4 miles down, way down there. I remember having those set up way down at the end of Cattle Gulch. And, oh, not 3 or 4 miles, but at least a mile and a half. And you couldn't afford to go back up to the headquarters. And sometimes we'd even, it didn't seem like we took lunches in those times, but they would try to transport some food. But it seemed like we'd ride back up there. Well, we couldn't take the team. We'd hook them up to a place and feed them there and water them. I remember several places we had like that. And it took a lot of management. It took a fellow almost to wait on them, you know, have that feed and have hay and have these wagon boxes there. And you just had to be around all the time. He would be riding around in a buggy or a horse most all the time, be available. Because if a man wasn't working, he had to have his operation going. That's what I say, it took management. And it took a lot of fortitude to do that. You could just waste the whole thing away, there's no question about it. If you didn't get your crop in, you didn't take care of your livestock, you didn't use your men efficiently, and was careless, I think lots of fellows went by the wayside that way. Of course, there's not too many people who were operating a unit like he was. They had maybe 160 acres. It was a family unit. A man went out and worked. His children worked. They worked a garden. They had a few pigs. They had a cow. And there was lots of that, you see. So actually, that's why his system was unit was a little more unique. It was large enough that you had that kind of operation. And people looked at that to be a big farm.
Well, in those days, it must have been. I mean, it must have been. Would you say that it was one of the very biggest around?
Yeah, it was one of the largest in this area.
Do you know of anybody that was farming more than 2,000 acres?
No, I don't. I think that was about the largest farm operation around then.
So he was having to work in a whole different dimension. I mean, having to, like when you were mentioning to me a little before about the hog part of the operation, would you describe that to me again? And you said you actually went over to Wallowa County to pick up the hogs.
Oh yeah, those in those days they didn't have the marketing program that they have now, like an auction. You could go down to Lewiston and sell and buy, and people would come in. In those days, it's just like I said, he was a trader, like any horses, and he would go out here at the farm and find out some way, or maybe a fellow would have, and he would buy his pigs and set a price on them. And even we'd buy calves. Some fellow didn't have them, they didn't take them to the sale. Didn't have a point to sell. And then we went over into the, like I say, when we wanted to get a few more, we got into raising peas, and you had quite a bit of waste, and then you wasted your crops, you know, because you didn't have the mechanization now, and you had to waste, so you had to pick that up through livestock. We had tight fences to hold sheep and hogs in. And so we would go over in there, and I remember going way over into the Enterprise area, over above Anatone and Soton, and buy pigs over in there back in that country, because those people could raise pigs and they didn't have the grains back in there to feed them out, see? They could keep a sow and feed them and keep that there, and would raise the pigs from this, and of course they had the manpower to do it, and the facilities, and the weather was pretty nice back in there. Over here it was colder, and you'd lose your pigs in the wintertime, so we'd go back there and buy up those pigs, and the farmers would sell them to us, and we'd bring them back here and fatten them out, because we had the waste, wheat and peas and what we'd harvested, and some damaged and stuff like that.
You would truck over there?
Yeah, that was later when we had, you know, the earliest kind of a truck. It was a small Ford truck, you know, nothing like they got to these days. We had double deck sometime back there, and I remember one time we were back there and there were so many pigs available that we built a double deck there with a farmer way back there in the Enterprise area. Stayed all night with him. Get back there and stay all night with the fellow.
How many would you made on it? Would you brought back on a trip like
that? We would get maybe 50, 60 hogs, maybe more than that sometime then. And I remember going up here to Cul-de-Sac, down here to Lapway. You know, you go up in there, there's a little place of Cul-de-Sac up in there. I remember going up there as a boy, was a fella, and we bought pigs back there before they had electric lights up there. They had gas lights in that little hotel. We stayed in the hotel at night, and we'd buy pigs and gather them up, you know. We'd buy them, and then, of course, we were that far, we would go back the next day and buy enough when we know how many we had, and we go back and pick them up and then bring them home the next day.
How old were they usually when you picked them up?
Oh, they would be about 6 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, how long would you keep them?
Well, we'd have to keep them till that would be spring phase. We would probably fatten them out in the fall. It'd have to be 6 months.
So you get them in the spring, yeah. Sell them in the fall?
Yeah, they would probably born, they'd be 6 weeks, they would be like to 2 months, you know, and we'd keep them 4 months.
You'd be turning them out then as soon as you got them on what was left?
Well, no, we'd feed them a while then. We used to get buttermilk at the dairy down in Lewiston and feed them along there and nurse them up a little to get them up to what they call feeder pigs. They'd get 60, 70 pounds. And then we could turn them out and they could wrestle. They couldn't wrestle that young. So you'd have to get them up to what they call shoats, feeder pigs.
Now, so there was a lot of waste then for them to get.
Yeah, you'd have to figure there'd be 10, 15, sometimes 20%. Because you had your roads and you had this machinery that you couldn't get down stuff. If you had some down stuff, you had high straw then and you couldn't pick it up with the mechanized systems we have now, you'd just have to run over it. And peas would, when we were mowing peas, we'd shatter them, and you had to throw them again on with a fork. And so you'd have that much to pick up. If you didn't pick it up, if you didn't turn it into meat in your animals, well, it was lost. So that was a quite a complete program that way.
What about the sheep part of it? That was
The sheep. Of course, you'd shear those sheep. I remember shearing. The fellows would come and we'd shear those sheep, and we had to hire 1,000 head of sheep one time. And they would live off of. So we used to summer follow, what they call a summer follow, and there would be a lot of growth in the summertime on that, and these animals would pick that off. Tumbling weeds and all kind of weeds, they would pick that up instead of spraying. We had these sheep, you know, and we could put them on wheat, too, if it got a little big.
If
it got a little too big, you know, the foliage got too heavy, well, we'd trim it down. We'd pasture it down and do that in the spring. And it makes it stool out a little better. And we'd keep those sheep there, and we put the hay, put up hay, and it seemed like there was enough feed to keep those.